distant and silent, but in the person of your Son, you have come close and spoken to us. Help us to listen to Jesus' words, spoken and written down many years ago, and yet this morning may they come by your Spirit with power and life. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Please take a seat. Well, this week was the 225th anniversary of Mozart's death. And some theatres across the country put on performances of Amadeus, which is a play about the rivalry between Mozart and another composer, his rival composer, Salieri. And in this play, these two characters, Mozart and Salieri, could not be more different. Salieri works slavishly hard, and he tries to obey God in absolutely everything, in the desperate hope that God will bless his musical endeavours. So Salieri slaves away, and he resists wine and women with this kind of expectation that God's going to bless his music. Mozart, on the other hand, is just naturally really good at writing music. So from the age of 5, he's writing little pieces of music. By the age of 8, he's written his first symphony. And Mozart, on the other hand, just lives as he wants. He's engaged to be married, and yet he's sleeping around. He doesn't deny himself any pleasure. Now, much of the play is fictional, but it presents these two characters and two groups, actually, of people that maybe we'll recognize in the world around us. Sinners, on the one hand, and slaves, on the other. So sinners are those who opt out of the system in order to seek pleasure and self-discovery and freedom. Like Mozart, they don't allow traditions and morality to get in the way of what they want. But slaves, on the other hand, are those who work within the system. They obey the rules and work hard to be blessed by God, in Salieri's case, or by the education system, or by the work that we find ourselves in, or by relationships with other people, whatever it might be that the system we work in to find approval and blessing. So sinners and slaves. And as we look around us, maybe we'll recognize those groups of people in others or in ourselves. Sinners who search for freedom and self-discovery, and slaves who strive for moral conformity and control. The difference might be put like this: those who protest by occupying Parliament Square, and those who protest by writing a strongly worded but polite letter to the Telegraph. Well, in our passage today, we have these two groups very clearly presented to us. So if you'll look with me at Luke 15 and the passage that was read out earlier. I'll just begin by reading the first two verses, which really set the context for the parable. So this is Luke chapter 15. We'll read verses 1 and 2. It's on page 1048. We read verses 1 and 2. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering round to hear him. This is Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." The sinners are easy to spot. They're actually called sinners in the passage. They're the tax collectors and sinners who are gathering, eager to hear what Jesus has to say. Who are the slaves? Well, in this account, they are the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And they're the ones that kind of stay at a distance, and they mutter and grumble because Jesus is welcoming sinners. And it's in this context that Jesus tells three parables. Duncan looked at the first two last week, the parable of the lost sheep and the lost coin. And today we're going to be looking at the parable of the lost son. That's the title that it gives us in the Bible here. Some of us will know it as the parable of the prodigal son, one of the most famous parables Jesus told. But you'll notice that I'm actually calling it, if you look on the back of your notice sheet, if you're a note taker, I've entitled the sermon the parable of the two lost sons. You see, our passage today is not about one son, but two. If we were to fast forward through the parable, we'd see two responses to Jesus, two responses to the grace of God. The response of one son, who represents the sinners, the response of a sinner searching for freedom, which is our first point, and then the response of the slaves, who are the second group, the Pharisees and the tax collectors, the slaves striving for control. Those are our two points this morning: a sinner searching for freedom and a slave striving for control. So let's look together, shall we, at this parable. I'm sure it's familiar to some of us, but let's hope that we'll see something fresh in it this morning. So our first point, a sinner searching for freedom. There was a Christian speaker who'd been invited to give a talk about Christianity in a retirement home. So he went in, and he thought he'd try and wake up the group a little bit. I thought maybe they'd be a bit sleepy. So he started by saying something a little controversial. He said, it's easier for a bad person to get into heaven than a good person. And his text was the prodigal son, and he said, look, the younger son, the bad son, got into the feast. The older son, the good son, didn't. And he'd hoped that it would cause a bit of a stir, but he didn't expect to get heckled, which is what happened. Don't get any ideas this morning. But one of the older ladies shouted back, are you saying then that we have to become bad to get into heaven? And he said, quick as a flash, no, madam, we already are. We already are. Now, we might not initially recognize ourselves as bad people, but let's just look at how Jesus describes this first son in verses 11 and 12, which is the beginning of our parable. Jesus continued, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. Now, to Jesus' original hearers, this behavior is shocking. This younger son wants his inheritance now. The only problem is that his father's still alive. In effect, he's saying, I wish you were dead. I wish you were dead so that I could have your stuff and have freedom to spend it how I want. And so verse 13, not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. Perhaps we can identify with the lady that heckled the Christian speaker. I doubt many of us have wished our family dead and kind of stolen all of their stuff and squandered it all in wild living. But I think that this son's attitude isn't as far away from our own as we might think. How many of us have enjoyed the good things that we've been given in life and yet not thanked and loved the good God who has given them to us? How many of us have enjoyed life, fulfillment, health, family, and yet not thanked the creator and the sustainer of all of these things? Not lived in line with how he teaches us to live. Perhaps most importantly, not loved him. If we're honest with ourselves, all of us by nature are sinners searching for freedom. Happy to get God's stuff, but not really wanting anything to do with him. But where is that heading? Where is that direction heading? Well, let's look at what happens to this younger brother in verses 14 to 16. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. The younger son goes for riches, but he ends up penniless. He goes for freedom, but he ends up a slave. He goes for feasting, but he ends up starving. And he goes for riotous living, but he ends up in the pigsty. And for a Jew, that really was the lowest of the low, a slave working with pigs, a bunch of ceremonially unclean animals. And as many other sinners in search of freedom have discovered, this younger brother discovered that the far country is a mirage. The reality is the pigsty. Perhaps not at first, but eventually. And so this morning, if you are tempted by the offer of freedom in a far country, then can I encourage you, don't be fooled. Don't be fooled. Perhaps it's a midlife crisis where anything new or younger or expensive or just different seems so exciting. Well, it promises freedom. It looks like it promises freedom, but don't be fooled. Perhaps we're here and we're eagerly waiting to kind of move out of our parents' home. Perhaps spend time and money away from their watchful eye, able to do things that previously we've not been allowed to do. Well, it looks like it promises freedom, but don't be fooled. Or maybe we're desperate for our kids to leave home, to fly the nest. Or maybe we're anticipating that retirement that's coming up soon. chance to suddenly indulge, to escape, to live as we want for a change. It looks like it promises freedom, but don't be fooled. Ultimately, don't think that living in this world, enjoying all of the good things that God gives to us, without enjoying God, the giver of them. It looks like it promises freedom. Life in this world without God looks like it promises freedom, but don't be fooled. Well, the first son's search for freedom hasn't gone so well. And many of us, when we read this passage, we think that the kind of transition in the story, the turning point in the story, is here in the pigsty. We think that the son realizes the error of his ways and just wants to go back home to be with his dad. I'm not so convinced. Let's have a look at verses 17 to 20 together. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.' So he got up and went to his father." Now, I'm not convinced that the turning point in the story is here in the pigsty. Let me just give you three reasons why I'm not convinced. Firstly, it doesn't quite match the pattern of the other two parables that have just preceded it. So last week we were learning about the shepherd who was looking for the lost sheep, or the woman who was looking for her lost coin. Jesus is looking for the lost. Doesn't fit the pattern from last week. Secondly, I think that the younger brother's words would have been recognized by Jesus' original hearers. Verse 18, he says, "I've sinned against heaven and against you." Those are the exact words that Pharaoh in Egypt, when he comes to his senses after all of the plagues, says. But we know that those were self-motivated words. It didn't really lead to any lasting change. And then thirdly, look at the son's plan in verse 19. His plan isn't to go home and move back in and suddenly become a son again. No. It's not that he suddenly loves his father. His words in verse 19 are a job application. He wants to become a hired worker. He isn't coming home. He just thinks he might get a better job there. He wants to go from being a sinner to a slave, from somebody who's a rebel to somebody who's working within the system. I'm convinced that the turning point, and you can challenge me afterwards if you think I'm wrong, but I'm convinced that the turning point in the story is not the son looking for a job in a pigsty, but rather in verse 20. Have a look with me at verse 20. "Well, he was still a long way off. His father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him." Jesus makes it clear that the father runs to the son. Well, he was still a long way off. Before the son has a chance to say anything, the father throws his arms around him and kisses him. And the son does try his sorry speech and job application, but the father cuts him off before he even gets to the job application. In verse 22, the father says, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." In our modern society, we think it's great that the son got his act together and decided to go home. For Jesus' original hearers, it's the father's behavior which is so shocking and wonderful. The son had no idea upon returning whether he'd even be lucky enough to get a job as a slave. Who is it that brings the son back into the family? Well, it certainly wasn't the son coming to his senses. It's the father. The father does everything. The father welcomes him in and brings him home, and at great expense to himself. He's already given away half of his estate, remember? But not only that, he gives him the best robe, which would have been the father's robe. He gives him a ring, which represents the family's authority. This son being welcomed back is being welcomed back as an heir, not as an outcast. He gets sandals put on his feet to set him apart from the servants. Again, it's the son returning, not a slave. and the fattened calf is slaughtered to feed their many guests to welcome the son home. His son was dead and is now alive. Today we're quite good as a society at turning sinners into slaves. Those who regret lifestyle choices that they've made can kind of have a turnaround to get back into the system and turn their lives around. And we celebrate that kind of thing on TV and in films all the time. So lots of our New Year's resolutions coming up, I'm sure, will be, we've known we've not been doing the right thing. We'll go from a kind of a life of self-indulgence, if you like, to a life of control. We'll stop doing what we knew we shouldn't have been doing all along anyway, breaking all of the rules, and we'll start doing what we thought we should have been doing. The world is pretty good at turning sinners into slaves. But this story is something very different. The world turns sinners into slaves. Jesus turns sinners into sons. The world would listen to this sorry speech and expect a good deal of hard work as he tries to sort himself out. But God's extravagant kindness is seen when this waster just slumps into the father's arms, still smelling like pigs probably. And he's kissed and welcomed as a son. Nothing merits that kind of extraordinary, extravagant forgiveness. It's only the result of the father's loving kindness. That's the turning point. Now, maybe you're here this morning and you are running as fast as you can to the promise of freedom in a far country. Or maybe you've been in the far country for quite some time. Can I tell you this morning, there is no country too far from the Father's welcoming love. And his message to us this morning is, whoever you are, whatever you've done, come home. Come home. Now, in many retellings of this story, it ends here, doesn't it? But that's only half of the story. This is a story not about one brother, but two. There is not one lost son, but two lost sons. So let's have a look at our second point. Our first point was a sinner searching for freedom. Our second point is a slave striving for control. And let's have a look at verses 25 to 27 to see what happens next. Meanwhile, the elder son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." Now, if this older brother was anything like his father, he'd be overjoyed, wouldn't he? You've almost got this contrast. The older brother's in the field working. Everyone else is at home celebrating. It kind of gives you a bit of an indication of the kind of guy that he would have been. But this brother is nothing like the father either. He doesn't, if he was, he'd just go in and celebrate, but he doesn't. Look at verse 28. The elder brother became angry and refused to go in. The father's first son caused him disgrace by running away and wishing him dead. The second son disgraces him by refusing to come into the celebration. But again, does the father just kind of sit and wait for the son to change his mind? No. Again, verse 28, the older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. Now, if we're familiar with Jesus' teaching, perhaps thinking back even over the last couple of weeks to some of the things we've seen in Luke's gospel, we'll be aware that Jesus reserves some of his harshest words for the religious elite, the Pharisees and the tax collectors, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law of his day. For those who slavishly follow the rules, but for those who hate him for welcoming sinners. But here we've got a wonderfully gracious picture of the father going out and pleading with his son. You see, Jesus wants both sinners and slaves to come to heaven. But how does the son respond to this gracious invitation? Verse 29. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders." And this is where we learn, really, the ugly truth about the older brother. His heart spills over in anger. See the words he uses to describe his relationship with the father? Slaving. "I've never disobeyed you," he says. And at root we learn that this son is a slave striving for control. He's been slaving all these years, obeying and doing what the father wants, but only so that eventually he'll get what he wants. You see, each son tried to get what they wanted from the father. The younger son did it by being very bad, and the older son just did it by being very good. But this son is just as far from the father as the other son was. That may not have been riotous living, but it certainly wasn't loving the father, enjoying being a son, cherishing their relationship. He wanted to use his father just as much as the other son had. Neither son loved the father for himself. If the younger son is the picture of rebellion, then the older son is the picture of religious obedience. And neither route is the right one to relationship with God. Jesus is teaching us that religious people are like slaves striving for control. They believe that somehow they have leverage with God because he owes them because of how they've lived. They think that they have the right to tell the Father how he should use his robe and his ring and his slippers and his livestock. Well, they've earned that right, haven't they, because of how they've lived. God should help and bless me because I've worked hard to obey him. But striving for control like this is disastrous. Because what happens when somebody who's worked really hard for something doesn't get what they hoped for? Well, it's anger, isn't it? When things don't work out as they wanted, anger. Anger with God, anger with other people. That's what we see in this story, anger at the father and anger at his younger brother. So perhaps this morning we've been diagnosed with a chronic illness. Are we angry? Do we think that somehow God owed us because of our religious obedience? Recognize the older brother in yourself. Do we serve God for the things that he gives us or because we love him? Or perhaps we face financial difficulty or work is going badly or whatever it might be, are we angry? Do we think somehow that God owes us because of our religious obedience? Do we serve God for the things that he gives us or because we love him? This parable teaches us that sin is much deeper than just breaking the rules. If we serve God to get leverage, if we slave for God to get stuff from him, if we work hard to earn things from God, well, that's sin too. Rather than enjoying the relationship of a son, we strive for control as slaves. Aren't you thankful that Jesus didn't just stop after the first son, but went on to this? Isn't this such an important message for us to hear this morning? It's like a mirror being held up to us as a congregation, so that those of us who are, in a sense, older brothers can see ourselves reflected back and see the danger that we're in. I think that this older brother is in more danger than the younger because he doesn't see himself in need of saving. If you're sick, you'll go to the doctor and you'll get treatment and hopefully get better. If you don't even know you're sick, then you're never going to go to the doctor and never go to get treatment. It could be fatal. How does this story end? Let's look at verses 31 and 32. My son, the father said, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Once again, the father is revealed as the generous host of a banquet of grace. He's the one who comes running to sinners and to slaves, who embraces them, kisses them, and seeks to be reconciled with them. In effect, the father says to the older son, as the older son is on his way back in from the field, from working and slaving, he says, lay down your shovel. Come and join in the celebration. And then the story ends, kind of abruptly. Now, perhaps some of you think that I've been a bit unfair when I've been speaking about the older son. Maybe you think the father is treating the older son in a little bit of a harsh way. Is it unfair? Is the older son quite as bad as I've made out? Well, the story looks like it ends on a cliffhanger, doesn't it? We're kind of thinking, how's the older son going to respond to this father's invitation to come in and celebrate? Well, it looks like a cliffhanger, but it isn't. Do you remember the context? Luke 15, verse 1 and 2. Jesus is speaking this parable to sinners and to slaves. To sinners, the tax collectors, the prostitutes, the sinners of the day who are gathering around to hear. They're represented in the first son. He's speaking it to slaves too, represented by the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. We know what the older son does next because we know what the Pharisees and the religious leaders of Jesus' day do next. They gang up together and they have Jesus crucified. We know that in effect this story ends when the older son picks up the shovel and beats his father to death. It's pretty sobering. This parable is about how people respond to Jesus' grace and generosity, held out to sinners and to slaves. The Pharisees hated Jesus because he welcomed sinners. Remember, Jesus wasn't killed by a mob of sinners. He was killed by moralists, by slaves striving for control. And yet, it was Jesus' execution, the cross of Christ, that would have welcomed any of them home. With arms opened wide on the cross, wide enough to embrace sinners or slaves who would come to him for mercy. You see, Jesus didn't just give us his best robe. He was stripped naked. He didn't just associate with sinners. He became sin for us. He didn't just sacrifice the fattened calf. He sacrificed himself. He didn't just come out of the house and plead with the sun and with sinners. He was shut out of heaven as darkness fell as he was crucified. For whom? Well, for all of those who would turn to him, sinners and slaves, as they would look to him for mercy. Jesus was stripped that we might be robed. He was made sin that we might be made righteous, torn apart like bread, blood spilt from his side like wine from a bottle, so that we might become and be invited to join and celebrate in that feast. In the cross of Christ, we see God's heart for sinners and for slaves. And the story, well, it was originally left open-ended because Jesus wanted a reaction from the Pharisees and from the teachers of the law. But it's left open-ended for us today too, because this parable demands a response. How will we respond? I don't know who you identify with in the story. Maybe it's the sinner who's in a faraway land searching for freedom. Maybe it's the slave who's at home but has been striving for control all these years. Or whether you see yourself in the pigsty or in the older brother who's standing on the outside of the party, angry and looking in, Jesus invites us this morning to be a son or a daughter. He has done everything necessary for us to be welcomed into the family. All we must do is respond to his invitation. There is no country too far from his welcoming love. And his message to us this morning is, whoever you are, whatever you've done, come home. Amen.